people laugh through their noses, sounding something like this.
Dreadful.
Some people laugh through their teeth, goodness sakes, hissing and fizzing like snakes. Not at all attractive to my way of thinking.
Some laugh too fast. Some only blust.
Ah!
Others, they twitter like birds.
You know, you're as bad as he is.
Then there's a kind what can't make up their mind.
That's I Love to Laugh from Mary Poppins. Laughter is a basic human behavior, and yet scientists are only now learning why we actually do it. Dr. Robert Provine is the world's leading scientific expert on laughter and the author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation, which is published by Viking. His explanations for why we laugh may surprise you, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to Please Explain. Hello, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Oh, pleasure to be with you.
And if you have calls for Dr. Provine, call us at 212-267-9692, 212-267-9692 with your questions about laughter. Dr. Provine, there aren't a lot of books on the science of laughter. Yours was published in 2000. Why did such a basic behavior remain unstudied for so long?
Well, it's had attention of a lot of people for a long time, even since Plato and Aristotle. But attending to laughter itself is a relatively new endeavor. People have written many essays about why we laugh, the politics of laughter, the power of laughter. But typically, there was confusion between humor and laughter, and laughter got left out in the confusion.
In the confusion. When did you first start studying laughter?
Well, I came to laughter through a background in neuroscience. I was interested in how the brain produces and controls behavior, and laughter was a great scientific problem. We do it all the time. It's important in everyday life. So when I was interested in looking for the neurological bases of human behavior, laughter is the perfect place to look. We all do it. It's simple in structure. It's easy to describe. And as a bonus, it's contagious. So in looking at laughter, we can not only study how the brain produces behavior, but we can study a heritable social act. We laugh when we hear other people laugh. So we've inherited a social mechanism.
What was the prevailing wisdom about laughter at the time when you started studying it?
Well, typically, laughter was treated as synonymous with humor. We found in observations of everyday life that's clearly not the case. Perhaps only 10 or 15% of everyday laughter follows anything that's remotely joke-like. We had found most laughter follows comments like, well, I've got to go now, or, hey, here's Joe, where'd you get that shirt, I've got to go to class now, comments like that. These wouldn't pass as jokes in the world's worst sitcom.
Right, exactly.
And yet these are the comments that are produced before laughter. So we found that laughter is not a response to jokes. Laughter and humor is something very different. What we did find is while a joke is not important to produce laughter, another person is. If you want more laughter in your life, spend time around other people. Laughter is 30 times more frequent in the presence of other people when you're alone.
Again, we're taking your calls on laughter for Please Explain Laughter here on the Leonard Lopate Show. I gave out the wrong number before. I apologize. 212-433-9692. 433-WNYC. Dr. Provine, what were you surprised by when you first started studying laughter? Was that basically it, that it wasn't connected really to jokes, that it was more this social lubricant to ease tension?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of surprises. One surprise was that the scenario of stand-up comedy and humor, you know, is not suitable to understand everyday laughter. Laughter is about social relations. It's not about jokes. Laughter is a message that we send to change the behavior of other people. And yet it's sent unconsciously. You know, we don't choose to laugh the way we choose a word in speech. If someone says something that entertains you, you don't decide, I'm going to laugh now.
Right.
It simply happens. But if you look at these patterns, we find it's very lawful, and it tells us a lot about the relations between people. Next time you go to a cocktail party, you know, we have with a Christmas season tending, there's going to be a lot of them. If you go to these parties and know what to look for, you know, you can tell what people really think about each other. Since laughter is not censored and we can't consciously control it, it's an unconscious, honest expression of our real feelings. One thing that we found, for example, is that men are the best laugh getters. Women laugh most in the presence of men. Men laugh least in the presence of women. You know, both men and women laugh a lot. But if you look at laugh patterns, you can tell what people think. Women laugh most in the presence they are attracted in the presence of men they're attracted to. And men are attracted and like women who laugh in their presence. So there's a case by listening to laughter patterns. You can tell what people really think. This was a big surprise to me.
Why? How does gender affect how much someone laughs? Why, for example, why do men think the Three Stooges are funny and many women don't? Does it have something to do with empathy?
Well, since laughter is not consciously controlled, yeah, we can't consciously produce it very effectively. It's easy to tell when someone's faking laughter. We're pretty good at inhibiting it. But the in trying to read laughter, the best way to deal with it is not try to think our way through it, because it's not a rational process. The best way is to simply look at behavior. And we find that men are attracted to women who laugh in their presence. It may be because of this would be interpreted as recognizing their status as an alpha male. Women don't decide to laugh more in the presence of men. They simply do so. And men probably don't know why. They may find, Donna or Mary so attractive, but their laughter may be part of their charisma, their attraction. Women may laugh most in the presence of alpha men, even though they don't recognize what they're doing at the time.
We're going to take your calls. Give us a call at 212-267-9692. Kyle from Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, thanks. My question was, what, if anything, is the difference between laughter from being physically tickled and the laughter you get from, like, hearing a joke or any of these interactions that we're speaking of? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, good question. As part of our research, we have looked at tickle. And tickle is probably the ancestral stimulus for laughter. The ha-ha of modern human laughter had its origin in the panting, the labored breathing of rough-and-tumble play. So pant-pant became ha-ha. And so rough-and-tumble play and tickle was probably the primal laughter scene. So it had its origin in physical play. And in adult humans, the scenario for most laughter is the more intellectual, linguistic play of conversation. In children, when we see the rough and tumble goings-on there, we're sort of revisiting our chimpanzee heritage. In regard to the physiological and the acoustic equivalents, the laughter associated with tickle and that of, let's say, a response to humor or social stimulation is probably similar. There's only so many ways to laugh. One of the best demonstrations of this is try to laugh in other than the normal way. You might think about a kind of Santa Claus laugh, a or a ha-ha-ha, or a in all these cases, we have a pulsative, a regular, a stereotype pattern. We have a burst of sound and a period of silence. In fact, you can describe laughter is a burst of sound lasting about a 15th of a second that repeats every fifth of a second. And it's hard to laugh in other than that way. You know, think about what a really fast laugh would sound like. Or a ha, ha, ha. Doesn't sound very laugh-like.
So it physiologically, it really breaks down to very regular patterns of breathing?
Yeah.
You can define a certain sound sequence and say, this is laughing, not singing.
Well, it's hard. Well, we're able to do that pretty reliably because you can try these experiments on yourself at home. Try to laugh in other than the usual way, faster, slower. There's a lot of constraints. And in fact, if you start to laugh very different than the standard, it doesn't sound like laughter anymore. Huh. In fact, if everyone laughed in a completely different way, we wouldn't know they were laughing.
We're going to take another call. Debbie from New Jersey, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what is going on physiologically when we laugh so hard that we cry?
Interesting point. First of all, it's a reminder that when we're looking at laughter, we're looking at a very crude social instrument. And when you look at a lot of the theoretical treatments of laughter, again, they're trying to put too fine an edge on a very crude, ancient social vocalization. In regard to tearing when we laugh, we also tear when we cry. We also tear when we yawn. And it's probably an expression of a general sense of physiological arousal. There's not much known about the physiological consequence of laughter. Clearly, it's a noisy vocalization that engages a lot of different body parts, so we're going to get an elevation of heart rate, an elevation of blood pressure. But there's a lot of other states that produce this as well. But one thing to remember about laughter, it's basically a sound that we make, a vocalization that evolved to change change the behavior of other people. We didn't evolve laughter to improve our health. And
yet it's been seen to have beneficial health attributes, right? It releases endorphins.
Well, actually, I'm not aware of a study that indicates that laughter produces an endorphin release. But I would say that isn't it enough that laughter feels good when we do it? Need we wait for the detection of an endorphin release to tell us it's okay to do it? One of the challenges of this is, again, we wouldn't be having this conversation if we were talking about talking or singing. We wouldn't be talking about whether we talk or sing to improve our health. We'd say, well, you know, talking is a sound that we make to communicate, to change the behavior of other people. And yet when we talk about laughter, we end up lapsing into its medicinal qualities. But clearly, I don't want to be a curmudgeon here, clearly a life filled with laughter is a good life. It feels good when we do it. Isn't that enough? But it's difficult to tease apart whether the physiological consequences that we see associated with laughter would not be associated with yelling, singing, or simply jumping up and down. Those studies haven't been done, including a lot of the folklore about laughter improves immune function and so on. Those kinds of correlates are a bit iffy. And even if we find them, are these changes the result of the act of laughter itself, a response to humor, or more probably a reaction to the social consequences in which we laugh? Since laughter almost always occurs in the presence of another person, if we find a correlation between well-being and laughter, it may simply be social support. So laughter is a good thing, a measure of good life. It feels good when we do it. Isn't that enough? And again, this is coming from someone who is a neuroscientist, and you know, through most of my career, I've done things like stain nerve cells, record electrical activity in the brain, and so on. But here's a case where I think a lot of the agenda about laughter is driven by the popular media, not what we've actually learned about the behavior.
I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Provine. He's a professor of psychology and the assistant director of the neuroscience program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. University of Maryland in Baltimore County, right?
Well, it's the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Okay, great. He's the author of Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. He's our guest on Please Explain Laughter here on the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. We will take more of your calls after this break.
Make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My grandpa said go out and tell them a joke, but give it plenty of hope. Make them roar, make them scream. Take a fall, but a wall split a seam. You start off by pretending you're a dancer with grace. You wiggle till they're giggling all over the place. And then you get a great big custard pie in the face. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
Let's Make 'em Laugh from Singing in the Rain, sung by Gene Kelly. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is Please Explain Laughter, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 433-WNYC. Dr. Provine, you say that it's very hard to, that it's a social mechanism, laughter is. So what happens when you put someone in a room alone, if you're setting up these studies to look at laughter, and
well,
you show them Saturday Night Live or an episode of Seinfeld?
Yeah, laughter disappears, basically, when you're alone. You laugh 30 times less when you're alone than when you're in the company of other people. This is when you exclude vicarious social stimulation, like watching television. Because after all, when you're watching the television, you have a social relationship with the people in the box, whether it be Leno, Letterman, or Conan. They're part of your group. Now, so would reading a book. But if you take away media, the people in the box, the people in the book, and the people in your head, basically you get rid of laughter. And this is also one of the reasons why that if you want to laugh more, spend time in the company of other people. In fact, my book's full of hints about how to get more laughter in your life. And clearly, the important solution is to get out of the house and spend time with friends, family, lovers. Don't go out and get a joke book or a comedy video. Mm-hmm. There's a lot better ways to get laughter. And if you're watching that comedy video, watch it in the presence of friends.
What about the derisive side of laughter, the famous insulting ha-ha from The Simpsons? Where does that side of laughter come from?
Well, laughter has two sides. We live in a kind of be happy, feel good, PC culture. We think, laughter is this light, pleasant topic. But we forget the darker side. In fact, this is the side of laughter that most attracted the ancients, and an aspect of laughter that would be rather mystifying if you go back and read these old works. You find that Plato spent a lot of time thinking about laughter because he feared its power. He saw that laughter would undermine the state and could lead to overthrow of the government. In fact, we see that now. If a politician is getting too much attention in the, the Tonight Show monologue, your political career is probably not going well. Now, we have a name for that kind of laughter. We call it jeering. Mm. We call it ridicule. But we forget in less PC times that laughter was present in public executions and things like that. So when you find rape, murder, things like that, laughter was there. The ancients saw it. Now, we forget about that. We forget that recently in street violence in Kosovo, Indonesia, and other parts of the world, people were laughing when they were stomping people to death in the streets. The boys at Columbine High School that were going through the hallways shooting their classmates, they were laughing.
And why is that?
Well, this gets at the issue of laughing with and laughing at. Now, the boys shooting their classmates were laughing with each other. It's a way of bonding together with members of your group and laughing at others. When we think about ridicule, it's a way of unconsciously shaping up individuals. So if someone's being laughed at, they're either going to shape up, you know, behave in a more suitable way, you know, such that they could rejoin the group, or they're going to be driven away. But laughter is very powerful. You know, consider violence on street corners or violence in the playground. Taunting and ridicule is an important element of it. So people who, you know, treat laughter as a kind of trivial topic forget that laughter is such a powerful stimulus that it can lead to violence and murder.
We're going to take another...
It does daily.
Oh, excuse me. We're going to take another call. Alice in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, I was calling the cultural aspects of laughter. I lived in China for a couple of years, only to discover that people, an individual would laugh when they felt embarrassed or uncomfortable. And, of course, if one's not sensitive to that, you know, you go on and they continue laughing, but, you know, you might be doing damage. I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Alice.
Well, there haven't been a lot of cross-cultural studies of laughter. There's some things I think that we can make a fairly clear statement about, is that whether it's laughter of an uncomfortable person, or laughter in response to jokes, or sharing stories with good friends, it is a social vocalization, and another person is present. It's also unconsciously produced. You know, for example, whether in the U.S. or China, if you're making someone uncomfortable and they're laughing for that reason, the individual laughing didn't decide to do it. It simply happened. There's big cultural differences in what constitutes a sense of humor. Some societies would more readily laugh at the misfortune of others, because we have to remember that there's been times when people would laugh at public executions. So sense of humor, the stimuli for laughter, can vary. But the way we laugh and its inherent social nature does not vary between cultures.
Thanks for that call. Carolyn from New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask, you mentioned that laughter is a vocalization, and how does that affect people who are mute?
Or people who are deaf.
Yes.
Actually, one of our most recent studies, came out within the last 6 months, I was looking at laughter amongst the deaf. It's been known for some time that deaf people laugh. No one's really looked into the details of that, and we've done so. What we found was that deaf people not only laugh during signed conversation, but they laugh at the same places during signed conversation that hearing people do. You know, for example, we find in laughter of hearing individuals, what we call the punctuation effect. While our speech is full of laughter, we laugh at pauses in speech. For example, a person will say, "I have to go now." They don't say, "I have to go now." So you laugh at pauses in speech. This indicates several interesting things, that laughter and speech are different. Are produced by different mechanisms, and also that speech is dominant over laughter because laughter seldom intrudes into speech. The same pattern holds for sign speech. So people in sign conversations of American Sign Language laugh at pauses and phrase breaks before and after sentences. So whether hearing or deaf, you know, the same laws governing when we laugh hold.
What about Carolyn's original question? What about people who are mute, people who can't vocalize?
Oh, excuse me, that are mute. Haven't looked at mute people.
I'm just wondering if it's so physiological, whether and so dependent on that vocalization. I wonder if mute people laugh. You haven't looked at that or seen any studies on that.
I'm not sure what would constitute a mute individual. You know, for example, a person would probably be able to laugh, although they might not be able to speak. for example, aphasics, who may not be able to speak, global aphasics, would not be able to speak or understand speech, will nevertheless laugh. Sometimes these individuals be sitting in front of a television, say listening to a comedy show, and they laugh at the appropriate place to jokes and laugh along with the soundtrack, even though they can't understand what's being said. There's enough non-linguistic material to support fairly normal laughter.
Thank you for your call, Carolyn. And Melissa from Hoboken has an interesting question for you. Melissa, you're on WNYC. Hello, Melissa.
Sorry about that. I had it on mute.
That's all right.
Now, in my family, we have an interesting phrase when someone starts laughing uncontrollably, and we say their giggle box is turned over. I'm very curious why some people seem to have like almost no control over laughter. They can get going on a laughing jag. Did you do any studies into, you know, the physiology of that?
Yeah, laugh jags are very interesting. First of all, an important thing to remember about laughter is it's not a choice. We're a lot better at inhibiting it than choosing to do it. But once we get into laugh mode, it's often hard to stop it. In fact, a lot of Christmas fare at a television and radio station Christmas parties may be airing tapes of uncontrollable laughter. The news anchor, the weather person, just can't stop. This also can happen during Shakespearean dramatic presentations.
Or
the harder
funerals.
You try to stop, the worse it gets. And it seems like once there's a warm-up effect, once you start to laugh, you keep laughing. If you look at comedy clubs, that's one of the reasons why the best comedians usually don't come out first. You don't want to send your worst person out first and give people a bad impression. But once you get people used to the idea of laughing, they're more relaxed. They're going to be more likely to laugh at material that comes later. And, so the notion that you see the laugh jag is, it's a very real thing. It's implemented in technology and entertainment. It's one more reminder that when we laugh, we're engaging our kind of primal, primate nature.
Melissa, thank you for...
We fancy ourselves as being conscious, rational creatures, but things like laughter, contagious or not, yawning, contagious or not, remind us of our beastly heritage.
Melissa, thank you for that call. Dr. Provine, what do you make of laughing epidemics? I understand there was one in Tanzania.
Well, the most notable laughing epidemic, and one that I describe in the book, occurred in Tanganyika. And involve some middle school girls who started to laugh and giggle. It spread from one to another and became so uncontrollable and widespread that they had to let the school out. And in fact, there were bouts on and off of this laughter epidemic over a two-year period. This was reported in the New York Times. And I also had found that it was more than just a quirk of a news story, that there were World Health Organization investigations of this and so on. The laugh epidemic was psychogenic. It was not due to food poisoning, some sort of influenza. It was due to something we all experience to a lesser degree. Any time that you sit in an audience and laugh with other people, any time a friend in conversation laughs and you laugh with them, that's a kind of mini epidemic. And the laugh jag that was mentioned earlier, when you start to laugh and just can't start, just can't stop, in Africa, we had this case where it went off and on for a very long time. The laugh epidemics have also been found in Europe at various times in history. Usually it's found in more often young people than older people, especially young women, say from 10 to 14 and through there. you're more likely to find it in less well-educated than more educated populations. But it's certainly not exclusive to Africa. We find it in other times in history. And again, we all have our own little laugh epidemics.
I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Provine. He's the author of Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and this is Please Explain. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And I have Bob from Brooklyn on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello there. I've been involved with improv comedy for quite a while, and I've always asked myself the question, what makes people laugh? I'm not concerned about laughing with other people. I never do laugh at the laugh tracks on TV or radio, but I wanted to know what makes for an audience to laugh. And I found that when we surprise them, that's when they laugh. So for me, the foundation for making people laugh is the element of surprise. I wanted to know what your professor had to say about that.
Dr. Provine, thank you for that call, Bob. Are there some elements of humor that provoke laughter,
Bob's right on target. From Aristotle right through the present, most theorists that have talked about what makes a joke funny, you know, what is there about a joke that causes us to laugh? It does have to do with an element of surprise. You're telling a story and it has an unexpected turn. Even Kant had discussed this. So there is always the element of surprise. But there's also the element of sociality. In a lengthy article in a recent Guardian newspaper, there was a prominent Irish comedian, Darrow Breen, who had said that he had found a lot of inspiration in my book. Well, my book is about the science of laughter. What is it? When do we do it? Why do we do it?
And Dr. Provine, I'm sorry, we will have to leave it there. We are running out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Robert Provine,
pleasure being with you.
Thank you, is the author of Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. Leave your comments for us online at WNYC.org about what makes you laugh. And this is WNYC. On Monday's show, President George W. Bush's former speechwriter Michael Gerson explains how he thinks the Republican Party should deal with the many challenges America is facing. Playwright Eduardo Machado shares his memories of the food of his Cuban childhood. We'll hear about the science issues at stake in the 2008 elections. And we'll also take a look at Blackwater from the perspective of its own employees. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Julia Corcoran, Tess Hartman, and Jacob Stevens. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Amy Eddings in today for Leonard Lopate. Thanks so much for listening.